William Sanderson Mayer has been writing a column called Jaundiced Eye for quite some time. I'm sure he'll tell us in a moment exactly how long. But it is the longest running political column in South Africa. It now appears on Politics Web, and the latest one published this morning was a cracker. We're going to pick up with him on many of the issues that he touched on there. How long has it been running for, William?
32 years.
32 years. Wow. So you've seen them come and go. And my goodness, have you ever seen anything quite like what we're going through at the moment in this republic of no consequences that we happen to live in?
Look, South Africa is always standing at a brink, and one always feels that this is as bad as it can get, and it can always get worse. And then it kind of like tide retreats, and we grab our breath again, and then off we set. So this is not a dramatic moment that we're having, but it's certainly a hell of a serious moment. And I think the danger is underestimating how serious it is. That I think a lot of things there's a confluence of circumstances. I think that, but one thing that is really different in my view is that there's a simmering discontent in the country. There are two things. In the middle classes, there's this frustration, this feeling that we're not getting to grips with things, and that it's intractable, that no matter how things bounce around in the GNU, we're not getting there. It's more than a year on. There's been no economic growth, and that was the main issue on which the DA joined the GNU, was to kickstart the economy. That hasn't happened. And I think there was a lot of voter support for that. There is still a voter support for that. But there was hope. It was a real moment of hope, I think. It was such an unusual. And again, this is where Ramaphosa confounds one, because he took a brave move there. Okay, it was to ensure the survival of the ANC, but it was a daring move. Anyway, so there's that hope which is thwarted, and at the same time, I feel there's a populist anger which is just waiting for something to set it off. And Mkhwanazi, if Cyril doesn't handle it well, might be that spark. Who knows? I mean, so many possibilities for sparks in South Africa. The other spark is the growing anti-migration, anti-illegal immigration thing, which is becoming quite strident.
Is this a feeling of deja vu of July 2021 in the way that you look at it? It's your home province, KZN, so you know all about what happened in 2021. Do you get a feeling of something similar?
I think it's broader than KZN, because KZN has always been the grit in the grease of South Africa's political system, right back through the National Party years and even before the formation of union. It's always been faintly out of step with the rest of the country. I think the simmering is broader than KwaZulu-Natal. KwaZulu-Natal could be the place where a fuse is lit, in the sense that all the major actors that we're talking about here, the Lieutenant General, the Minister of Police, the Deputy National Commissioner, all of those are actors in the KZN political firmament. And it is in KwaZulu-Natal where the ANC faces it retains control by a fraction, by a margin, by a hair's breadth.
Mm. But let's go into the Ramaphosa leadership, or lack thereof. Your column is titled Ramaphosa's Unraveling Presidency. And in essence, you say that the GNU is not living up to all of our hopes. Yet another, I suppose, dashed Ramaphoria moment because of his lack of leadership. Just quantify that for us, if you would.
Well, if we take it on the let's break it into two stages. The one stage is the local stage. His handling is not deft, to put it mildly. It's he's making missteps after missteps, misjudgments. His delayed response to Mkhwanazi's allegations of political interference and corruption with this police force took him almost a week to respond. Okay, he was away in Brazil, but I mean, he has flown home for less serious matters than that. In fact, it seems that every time he pops out of the country, there's a little crisis that pops up here, and he has to hurry home, or he has to delay, as he did very recently, his trip to Spain because of shenanigans or murmurings within the GNU. But it took him a week to respond. He responded in quite an extraordinary way, another little national conversation to which he pitched up 30 minutes late. I mean, that is really misreading the room. It gives the impression of a man of arrogance and aloofness and out of touch. I mean, you don't hold, and he keeps doing this. One of the post boasts of the post Zuma era was, you know, things are going to start on time now. But I mean, he's never on time. He indicates in his personal manner a disdain for the country, which is politically unwise. Whether he feels it or not, it's not a way you want to treat the people who are looking to you at quite a tense moment, and whose support and admiration you need. So that is, on a psychological level, he's out of it. It reminds me of a time, I'm sure you remember it, Alec, when he almost resigned. Was it 2 years ago, 3 years ago? He was frustrated about the Pala Pala thing, and it was a sort of, how dare you keep pushing me around like this? I'm out of here. And he was prevailed upon, I think, unfortunately, prevailed upon to stay. And his manner is that again, it's disdainful, it's arrogant, it's aloof, it's really unwise. But they're the practical things with Mkhwanazi. I mean, try to fob off South Africa. With another commission of inquiry is insulting. I mean, that fools no one, and it doesn't even satisfy parts of his own constituency. I think one of the really interesting things in there is that ANC legacy organizations like the Kathrada Foundation, like the Sisulu Foundation. I was just saying, no, this is enough. The Sisulu Foundation a week ago said he has betrayed the mandate. Essentially, I'm not quoting them accurately, but they're essentially saying that he's betrayed the mandate that the nation has entrusted him with. And on the Mkhwanazi issue is the example they use. And it's time for him to go. Now, I don't think that's going to push him into going. And also, of course, we don't know what happens when he goes, but we can look at that separately. But that the misstep after misstep on the local scene, the firing of Whitfield, it was such an extraordinarily... Why didn't he do it in February when Whitfield went off on his US jaunt without the permission of the president? He waited basically 5 months to do so. Why? So his actions puzzle and perplex and frustrate.
Well, the most recent thing that people are focusing attention on is the way that both Ramaphosa and the ANC generally have reacted to Emma Powell from the DA. Now, if you're sitting in the DA camp after what happened to Whitfield, you've got to be thinking very carefully, can we carry on working with these guys? The way they're coming at Emma Powell, after all she did was just tell the nation that comrade, Mr. BNC Jonas, and I'll tell you a little more about that in a moment because I had a look at this comrade, how well he's paid by MTN. But we'll get onto that a little later. But how comrade, Mr. BNC Jonas, should not have been attacked, and how Emma Powell is doing terrible things to the nation by acting in the way that she is. She's part of a right-wing grouping. They have a sustained campaign of harassment against Comrade Jonas, part of a cabal, etc., etc. I mean, these things are just off the charts. And all she did was say Ramaphosa made a real blue in appointing someone who was not allowed into the U.S. to go and negotiate South Africa's trade deal, which, of course, is impossible to do that if you can't get into the damn country in the first place. Is this could this be the final straw?
I don't know what the final straw would be. This is certainly another heavy straw to add to the camel's back. The reaction to Powell reminds me so much of the kind of response that the nationalists came up with in the closing years of apartheid, towards any criticism from the opposition benches. It was rage. It was how dare you question us? And it's a really bad issue to go for Emma Powell on because, as she points out, they have known since May that he's not allowed access to the United States on a diplomatic visa. He may very well have a tourist visa, but unless he wants to take in the sights in the capital, that's not going to help him a hell of a lot to get access to the White House. But I mean, apart from that, the president's spokesman at one stage conceded that when there was a discussion of why wasn't Jonas at the White House meeting, eventually the presidential spokesman conceded. Initially, they said, well, it's because he didn't want to go. I mean, he just turned up the trip. He didn't think it was important. All of that was left hanging. But it was a lie. And the presidential spokesman actually conceded that eventually, that yes, the U.S. administration has some reservations, I think is the phrase that he used about Jonas. So Powell has done nothing but state the truth and the obvious.
So Comrade Jonas is the chairman of MTN as well. And last year he got a 28% salary increase, which took his salary as a non-executive chairman to 7.3 million rand a year. Included in that was a million rand he was paid to attend their strat session. He's paid nearly 200,000 rand for each board meeting he goes to. And this is a comrade. Comrades were somewhat different in the olden days, I'm sure.
It's extraordinary numbers, those. I didn't know the degree, the lavishness with which he was paid. Given the problems that MTN face in the United States, that's another reason why he's an extraordinary choice. I mean, MTN has problems in the U.S. because of its Iranian link. And the allegations, unproven, admittedly, but four court cases of claims that under his chairmanship, essentially, at MTN Iran did deals via the Revolutionary Guard that endangered and caused the deaths of Americans. And also in those court cases are allegations of illegal technological transfer. So he's incredibly lavishly paid for a man whose actions are not helping South Africa's case in the United States.
Well, his CEO is paid over 60 million rand a year. So I suppose doshing out the cash at MTN is something that they go along with. I just want to dwell on Mkhwanazi for a little while, if you would. In the Sunday show yesterday with Chris Stein, Sarah Berger was saying she's no great fan of Mkhwanazi's way of doing things, given that she and her colleague, after exposing academic fraud at Fort Hare, were whisked off in jets under Mkhwanazi's, I suppose, orders. And she said spending hundreds of thousands of rands to put her behind bars when actually there is they're the ones who've got the cases to answer. So Mkhwanazi is not universally admired, but at this point in time anyway, at least the people in KZN do think that he's the good guy, he's somebody who should be supported. And your view, though, given that that's your kind of your old stamping ground?
There's not a single appointment made to the high ranks of any of the organizations or institutions in South Africa that are not tainted by the hand of cadre deployment and nepotism and political influence peddling. So I wouldn't be at all surprised to find that Mkhwanazi is tainted in some way or the other. But he may not be the white knight that some hope him to be. And I think that's a tendency we have in our politics. Things are so bad and we're in such desperate emotional and psychological need for a savior that anyone who comes riding over the horizon on a charger immediately has embraced as the next best thing. It doesn't matter. I think all that matters really is whether his allegations are true. And I find it very difficult to believe. And whatever his motivations are, there may very well be motivations that are clouded by the fact that there are pending illegal actions, criminal actions against him. I don't know. There have been those rumors and whispers. And of course, both factions are fueling those rumor mills. I don't know if it matters. We shouldn't expect him to be a good guy. He just has to be better than the lot he's trying to expose. And it is an indication of rottenness that there are no good guys in those places. Oh, and for that matter, in many of our other institutions, you know, who are the good guys at the South African Human Rights Council? Who are the good guys? I mean, you can go from Chapter 9 institutions right through every state-dominated agency or state-appointed agency, and they're rotten. They might be only 50% rotten or they might be 90% rotten, but they rotted.
William, how do you fix this?
You know, it's a frustrating thing. I mean, I've had several responses to columns saying, well, it's all very well, you know, what comes next? Do we get rid of Ramaphosa? Imagine what comes after Ramaphosa. I don't know. It's pointless to hang on desperately to a government on the basis that what follows might be worse. In fact, given the steady decline since 1994, each administration being successively worse than the previous one, we could be almost guaranteed the next one would be worse. And in fact, the one after that will be worse. The only solution is to vote out the ANC. I would think if an election were held now, and that is impossible even in terms of the Constitution, which is a subtlety I was not aware of until recently, even if a motion of no confidence is passed in Ramaphosa, there's no election. This administration has to serve for 3 terms before next general election. Sorry, for 3 years until the next general election can be called. So, if you have a vote of no confidence in Ramaphosa, all it means is you need to find a replacement for Ramaphosa. The National Assembly has to appoint a replacement for him, which I think is I would argue that is a very good thing for the DA to trigger at this stage. Pass a motion of no confidence. Throw it into the National Assembly, let the bickering begin, and eventually out of that something which may not be an ANC appointee, in fact, almost certainly won't be an ANC appointee, will come out of it. And that is better than the sort of thing where the next leader comes out of the ANC readily anointed. Look at the crowd that's waiting in the wings. I mean, Mashatile, Fikile. I mean, between a clown and a crook, it's very difficult to decide. So I'd say a motion of no confidence was a good tactic. That'll stir the pot somewhat.
I just want to ask you something on a different tack, but just as we close off, this whole academic ghostwriting squad at Fort Hare, which has got so has caused so much anger within the ANC that they will send jets to go and hire the investigators who were brought in to deal with it to begin with. Is it only at Fort Hare, or is it conceivable that it's only at Fort Hare that this is happening? And I ask this because there is this perception, it appears, within politicians at the moment that get yourself a doctorate or get yourself a degree, and then you've kind of made it. And I saw No Names, No Pactoral, some guy that I've met who I really have a low opinion for his intellectual capabilities, getting a doctorate from the University of Johannesburg. And I thought to myself, that's interesting. How the heck would this guy, a serving politician, have found the time to do it? And B, if we've got ghost squads sitting at Fort Hare, well, maybe there are ghost squads elsewhere in the country. William, you know these guys. You know how they operate. I'm from the world of finance where you can't get away with this garbage. Is it possible?
Bloody hell, Alec. I'm absolutely sure it's possible. I think we must not make a mistake of seeing each of these little eruptions of corruption that pop out like pustules all over the body politics, that they isolated to one place or to one sector. Yeah, I'm absolutely sure. The point you make is where do these people find the time to do a doctorate? It's a seven year process in a credible academic institution. They don't have the time, and most of them don't have the intellect to do so. They may well have the raw intellect, but many of the people who are sitting with doctorates, you think, well, they've come through a really bad education system, and they may have briefly attended not very good universities, and now suddenly they're clever enough to do a doctorate. Well, I would say I'm no doubt that the ghostwriting squads are. It's probably one of the biggest growth industries in the academic sector is providing the intellectual raw material for the next PhD.
And as an add on to that, an addendum to that, the new Minister of Police. Now, I don't know Kachalia from a bar of soap, but I presume he's a good guy and he knows his subject, but he's an academic. And it's almost like Ramaphosa loves academics rather than people who do things. So you've got to wonder, this lack of urgency that one sees, you don't get that in the real world. You can get that in the academic world where you are paid to think and read and so on. But is it really the best appointment to have a minister of police who has not served in the police, is coming from academia, and it's got a bit of there are a few question marks at the very least against him.
I think it's a huge mistake to have someone who has no law enforcement background. Being in the legal field is not a qualification for dealing with the police force. If they appointed someone from Institute of Security Studies who has been studying the police, I could understand that to some degree. But if Ramaphosa genuinely wanted to restore confidence in the police, it wouldn't be an ANC appointee. He would find someone elsewhere, someone who could at least be credibly believed to be not a toady to the ANC. I think Kachalia's things that worry me about most of him is he did an anti-corruption report for the president in 2022. I think it started, and it was post Zondo. What are we going to do post Zondo? The answer, of course, we all know is nothing. But he was happy to see that report buried. He didn't squeak. He didn't say, "Mr. President, this is time to release it, or we're releasing it." What kind of academic allows the intellectual process that he's been tasked to put together just to be buried and completely forgotten? I mean, where is the determination, steel. He doesn't seem to have any steel. I also find it really weird that he's got this, he can't start until the 1st of August because he's in the process of the next 2 weeks closing down his retirement fit as he leaves university. I mean, the South Africa is in one of its many national crises, and he has to hang around the university watch for some farewell parties. It's a little bit odd and absurd. So I don't have a lot of confidence in him. He's, of course, also one of the people who attacked Mkhwanazi earlier this year when Mkhwanazi came out with some of the allegations and said, you must go through the police process. Well, I mean, that's the whole point, isn't it? Mkhwanazi went to a public platform because he can't go through the internal processes because they are corrupt. So if all of those aspects of Petalia do worry me.
So we're on the fence again. We are on this knife edge, which we in South Africa seem to thrive on doing. We'll score a few own goals along the path. But I suppose from where you're sitting and you're looking at this whole show as it passes on, is there any upside, anything good? Do we have to go through this process perhaps to get to some kind of normalcy in our society?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's encouraging that this confluence of circumstances is really growing the pressure. I think that's very good. There has to be something has to crack at some stage or the other. It's not enough, and that's one of my problems with this obsession of keeping the GNU going. It is not enough for the status quo to continue till 2029, which is impossible in any case. Something has to snap somewhere along the line. Rather, let's get it over and done with and let's move on. We might have to drop a bit, but it's not working. South Africa's, the longer we take to address the real issues that exist in South Africa, the longer it takes us to solve them. It's going to take us 30 years to get back to where we were. So why would we want to wait for 33 years before we start the great trek backwards?
William Sanderson-Meyer is the columnist who writes The Jaundiced Eye, South Africa's longest-running political column. And I'm Alec Hogg from BizNews.com.